Scripture reading this morning is from the Gospel of John, chapter 9, verses 1 through 11. As he passed by, he saw a man blind from birth. And his disciples asked him, "Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind?" Jesus answered, "It was not that this man sinned or his parents, but that the works of God might be displayed in him. We must work the works of him who sent me while it is day. Night is coming when no one can work. As long as I am in the world, I am the light of the world." Having said these things, he spit on the ground and made mud with the saliva. Then he anointed the man's eyes with the mud and said to him, "Go, wash in the pool of Siloam," which means sent. So he went and washed and came back seeing. The neighbors and those who had seen him before as a beggar were saying, "Is this not the man who used to sit and beg?" Some said, "It is he." Others said, "No, but he is like him." He kept saying, "I am the man." So they said to him, "Then how were your eyes open?" He answered, "The man called Jesus made mud and anointed my eyes and said to me, 'Go to Siloam and wash.' So I went and washed and received my sight." They said to him, "Where is he?" He said, "I do not know."
There was a season in the life of my former church, the Union Church of Lima in Peru, when they were without a pastor. This was before I became pastor there. I was told this story on several occasions. They were filling the pulpit week by week, and on this particular Sunday, Russ Reinhardt was scheduled to preach. Russ is a gifted communicator, and before he retired, he'd spent his entire career working in Peru, in the Amazon, and then later in Lima. He worked with the Summer Institute of Linguistics, better known as Wycliffe Bible Translators. Like I said, Russ's career was marked on many remarkable levels, but certainly one of which was as a teenager, he lost his sight. Like the fellow in our Bible passage, he was a blind man. Now, as I mentioned, Russ was gifted, and sometimes when he would preach a sermon, he would do so in character. And so on this particular Sunday, Russ's plan was to preach as King David. And so in the program, it read the title of the sermon, and that said for preacher, it said, "David Jesson." Get it? David Jesse's son, Jesson. Well, the head of the church board at that time was Tom Walker, and Tom was an executive with SIP, the Potato Institute in Peru. Trust me, the potato is a big deal in Peru. However, no one informed Tom as to who was preaching that morning, and Russ was a little bit delayed in getting into the sanctuary, so Tom walked into the pulpit to ask if David Jesson was in the building. Russ was still in an adjacent room getting on his makeup and costume, and seeing no response for his search for David Jesson, Tom then told the congregation that he intended to offer an inspiring talk on potatoes and the Bible. Of course, the Bible does not mention potatoes. Potatoes were cultivated and developed in Peru. That's why the Potato Institute is there. But Tom was willing to give it the good old Wooster try. So he began his speech on spuds. At this point, King David walks into the room. Russ. Both men were well known and loved by the congregation, and there was no question as to which of the two was more qualified to deliver a sermon. Tom, however, was not ready to concede the loss of an opportunity to speak to a captive audience on the virtues of the potato. He suggested that they ask the congregation what should be done. "Whom would you rather hear speak this morning?" And Tom looked at the congregation and asked everyone who was present who wished to hear Russ preach to raise their hands. Then he looked at Russ and said, "Do you see any hands?" You know, if something terrible happens to us, like losing our sight as a teenager, it's the natural human question to ask, you know, why? What did I do wrong to deserve this? We might think that God is angry with us. We want to understand the world, and we puzzle as to why bad things happen to good people. The disciples ask, Rabbi, who sinned this man or his parents that he was born blind? Note the presumption behind the question. Somebody sinned. This man's hardship, trial, handicap had to be some form of punishment. He carries this burden because somebody should be culpable. Now, the key thing to note that such a question reflects a belief that there is a moral component to life. And in that sense, it's a good question, for it reflects the assumption that the world around us should be understood morally and spiritually. Now, sadly, there are many in our world today who do not believe that the world can or should be understood morally or spiritually. You know, no right-thinking Darwinian evolutionist could ever ask such a question. It makes no sense. There's no moral component in the Darwinian understanding of the world. You know, according to Darwin, the only two forces at work in our world are time plus chance. Natural selection is a blind watchmaker. There's no conception of sin in evolutionary understanding. And so, because evolutionary understanding refuses to acknowledge a place for God, it offers no explanations for why bad things happen. There's no room for a moral component to life. So this disciple's question, or the disciple's question, reflects a common idea at the time. The Jews believed that they believed in God. They understood that in life, the good are rewarded and the bad are punished. If something bad happens to you, it's because of something bad you did or someone close to you did. If something good happens, then that's a reward for being a good and honest man. The good get rewarded, the bad get punished. And you know what? This idea that the good get rewarded and the bad get punished, that continues today. Now, you may remember, I certainly remember it, on December 26, 2004, there was a major tsunami that struck Southeast Asia, killing thousands. Do you recall the commentary on the disaster? The Israeli chief rabbi, Shlomo Amar, said, "This is an expression of God's great ire with the world. The world is being punished for doing wrong." The Hindu priest, Pandit Harish Krishna Shastri, said this catastrophe was the result of a huge amount of pent-up man-made evil in the earth. A Malaysian Muslim cleric, Azayan Abudi Razak, saw in the ways a warning from God that he created the world and he can destroy it. A leading British Muslim cleric, Sheikh Ibrahim Mogra, said, "We believe that God has ultimate controlling power over his entire creation. We have a responsibility to try and attract God's kindness and mercy and not to do anything to attract his anger." Now, I didn't explain how the people of South Asia attracted God's anger. I mean, what was striking to me about this tsunami was that it appeared to be an equal opportunity natural disaster. In Thailand, the majority of the people who were killed were post-Christian European tourists. In Indonesia, most of the dead were Muslim. In Sri Lanka, the Hindu population suffered the worst. And on the southern coastal population of India, it was many Christians who were killed. What are we to make of such devastation? Is this God's punishment? Well, this is the sixth sign from John's gospel, and I think it helps us to understand things rightly. Before we look at our Lord's words in particular in answer to the disciples' questions, I want to remember that there are basically four sources of calamity in our world. The first source is nature. This is from Romans 8. "The creation waits in eager expectation for the sons of God to be revealed. We know that the whole creation has been groaning as in pains of childbirth right up to the present time." My friends, we live in a fallen world. Now, that's not how God originally created the world. At the end of each day in Genesis 1, each day of creation, God looks out upon his handiwork and he declares that it is good. The world as God created it was good. But sin entered our world through the disobedience of our ancestors, Adam and Eve. And Adam and Eve's sin had far-reaching impact. We call their disobedience the fall. And the Bible speaks of Adam and Eve, when it says that Adam and Eve, after the fall, were driven out of the Garden of Eden, what is being said there, the point is, the world is no longer the same as how God originally constructed it. The world is no longer good, in an absolute, complete sense. Like a knife gash in a grandmaster's painting, creation itself is now flawed. And the corruption is gone to the bone. And so creation itself bears part of the burden of Adam's sin. Creation itself is askew. The world God created good is now a place of earthquakes, volcanoes, tsunamis, typhoons, mudslides, avalanches, floods, and fire. As Paul puts it in his letter to the Romans, creation itself is groaning. It experiences the pain. It feels the harm. Now, the image Paul uses is that of the pains of childbirth. One day, the pains we feel will be forgotten when we see the glories that God has in store. But that day is not today. Today, we know the pain, the heartache, the suffering of creation, as we hope that one day God will make it all right. That's the first source of calamity in our world, nature. The second is ignorance. Proverbs 16:25. There is a way that seems right to a man, but its end is the way to death. I once visited and prayed with a man who was dying from emphysema. He was a young man in his early 60s. He had spent his career working in the auto shop, primarily painting cars. He'd worked in the days before masks and filters. And it was clear that the disease that was so painfully killing him now was the result of years of day in and day out breathing the paint and the turpentine and the fumes in his workshop. This man was suffering the side effects of ignorance. He and his co-workers did not know better. They did not know the damage they were inflicting upon themselves and on one another as they worked without protection in that environment. And the sad fact is that some of the trial and trouble that we experience in life is simply a byproduct of our unawareness. It could be prevented, but is not. So some calamity comes from the fallen world, some comes from ignorance, some is the direct result of human sin. For all have sinned and fall short of the glory of God. You know, Adam may have been the one to introduce the reality of human sin and disobedience into our world, but make no mistake, each of us signs his or her own name to that wall of infamy at some point in our lives. We each add our own contribution to the corruption of the world. Each of us has added to the unhappiness of others through the impact of betrayed trusts, broken relationships, harsh and uncaring words, self-centered motives. And at a higher level, each of us can find our world turned upside down as a consequence of the reality of crime, corruption, cruelty, or indifference. You probably heard the story. 2 weeks ago, 12 Christians were killed in an accident in Texas between a pickup truck and a church bus. It appears that the driver of the pickup truck was texting at the time, leading to the loss of control of his vehicle and the death of the people in the bus. Obviously, the driver of the truck didn't intend to cause an accident, although his negligence was sin. And as a consequence of his sin, a church and 12 families are grieving the loss of their loved ones. So calamity can come to us from the natural world. It can come out of ignorance. It can come as a result of human sin in all of its forms. Finally, calamity in our world sometimes comes as the result of the work of Satan. The Lord said to Satan, "Behold, he is in your hand. Only spare his life." You know, the scriptures teach that God is watching out for the good of those who belong to him. The scriptures also teach that Satan is loose upon the earth, seeking to accuse and cause pain and mischief where he may, where God permits him. It is a curious thing to me that many Jews and Christians insist on believing that there's some mathematical equation that can explain the suffering of a blessed person experiences in this world, when it's the clear and unambiguous message of the book of Job is that that is not the case. Job, at the beginning of the book, is one of the most wealthy and blessed men on earth. Then he loses his wealth, his family, and his health at the prompting of Satan and the acquiescence of God. And note well, Job does nothing. He doesn't merit either his blessed state or his state of anguish and pain. I mean, the message of the book is plain. The greatest sufferers are not the greatest sinners. Job is caught in a spiritual contrast between Satan and God that simply cannot be explained from the perspective of Job's life and sufferings. My friends, some trials and troubles are simply inexplicable from the vantage point of human life. The story of Job teaches an essential point, one that's reinforced by Jesus' answer to the question posed to him by the disciples. You know, calamities are not always punishments. A calamity may be a punishment. I mean, if you lose your temper and curse off your boss and you lose your job as a consequence, well, the calamity is clearly a direct result of your unbridled tongue. But if you lose your job because the factory has ceased to be profitable and the company has gone out of business, there's no moral burden at your door for that fact. Bad things happen in life. And so the question then is this: what should our attitude be towards, on one hand, trials and troubles, and on the other hand, the blessings and delights of life? Life is full of difficulty. Life is full of blessing. Well, the first thing I would say is that if you're blessed, be thankful. Neither this man nor his parents sinned, said Jesus. You know, one of the problems of the modern world, I believe, is the overabundance of rights talk. When we talk about human rights and civil rights and the right to privacy, to the life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, gun rights, property rights, animal rights, disability rights, children's rights, Medicare rights, intellectual property rights, cyber rights. Do you know that the University of Minnesota even offers a human rights library? Well, you get the point. The difficulty with rights talk is that it obscures the fact that life as we know it is a gift. Rights talk somehow implies that we have a transcendent claim to the blessings of life. We do not. None of us deserves anything. We do not deserve goodness and blessing. We have not earned these things. Whatever rights we have, and I do believe we have some God-given rights, we have them as an expression of God's love and continuing care over his creation. So what this means practically for us is that in life, if we've experienced rather little in the way of trial and trouble, if we have been blessed, we have an obligation to express our thankfulness and gratitude toward God. Whatever blessings we know in life, we know them not because we're worthy of them or because we have earned them in some cosmic competition. We count our blessings. We must acknowledge our gratitude to God for his kindness to us. The second practical application falls close on this one, and that is that if we face trial and trouble and pain, we should not accuse God of being unfair or unjust. Neither this man nor his parents sinned, said Jesus. The great Russian author Alexander Solzhenitsyn became a Christian through the witness of a Russian Jew named Boris Kornfield, who himself had come to faith in Jesus. Kornfield was a doctor, a prisoner like Solzhenitsyn in the Soviet Gulag. Solzhenitsyn was recovering from surgery for stomach cancer, and late one night, Kornfield, the doctor, sat down by his bedside and told him how he came to faith in Jesus Christ. Reflecting upon his conversion experience and his life in that terrible camp, Kornfeld added, and here I'm quoting, "On the whole, you know, I have become convinced that there is no punishment that comes to us in this life on earth which is not undeserved. Superficially, it can have nothing to do with what we are guilty of in actual fact. But if you go over your life with a fine-tooth comb and ponder it deeply, you will always be able to hunt down that transgression of yours for which you have now received this blow." Imagine, here is a man, a Jew, living in the midst of the cruelty of the Soviet gulag, saying that he deserved every indignity that he suffered. My friends, whenever something bad happens to us, our natural tendency as humans is to immediately think, what have I done wrong to deserve this, or why is God punishing me? And we think such thoughts because we know intuitively that we are not the men or women we ought to be. And what this means, what Boris Kornfeld said, is that whatever trial or tragedy befalls us, we know that no matter what has happened, there is an inherent justness to it. We know instinctively the truth of Boris Kornfeld's insight. Whatever we have received, we deserve. If we're blessed, we must be thankful. If we face trial and pain, we must not claim that God is unfair. Now, at this point, I'm going to pause and make a shift in this and make a candid acknowledgement to you. I'm going to do something that I've seen a colleague do. I've noticed on several occasions when we visited our daughter, Rebecca, that the pastor of her church, Redner Cain, that he preaches two sermons every Sunday. They're both good. I'm always happy to listen to them, but he goes through the thing and he preaches, and then I'm thinking, oh, that's a good ending, and then he goes back and preaches another sermon. I'm going to do that right now. I'm going to back up and because you notice, I've talked a lot about biblical passages, but I haven't talked about the text in front of us. So now we're going to look at the text a little more specifically. The first thing I would say about the text in front of us is that suffering can reveal to us the work of God. "Neither this man nor his parents sinned," said Jesus, "but this happened so that the work of God might be displayed in his life." Is there purpose in suffering? Jesus believed there is. The purpose of this man's blindness was not punishment. God had his reasons in his handicap. In life, there are things we can know, and in life, there are things we cannot know. Some things will always be a mystery. However, no matter what trial or difficulty we face, the works of God can be revealed in the midst of the hardships we face. This is clearly true in this story. For first, God is glorified in the physical healing of this man. Having said this, Jesus spit on the ground and made some mud with saliva and put it on the man's eyes. "Go," he told him, "wash in the pool of Siloam." You know, this is the sixth of the seven signs in John's Gospel. Each sign testifies to Jesus' power and authority. You know, when the blind man's neighbors find that he can see, that he's been healed, some of them do not believe that it is him. They think it's a case of mistaken identity. I mean, to heal someone who was born blind is unprecedented. It testifies that Jesus is more than a mere man, more than... Before he heals the blind man, Jesus says of himself, "I am the light of the world." The physical power to heal a man born blind testifies to the spiritual truth that Jesus is the light of the world. The physical healing is important to the blind man. The physical healing of this blind man is important for us because it points to the truth that Jesus is the light of the world. The way to understand the world is through the light, through the person of Jesus. If you wish to understand your place in the world, you must do so through the person of Jesus Christ. Next, God is glorified in this man was healed, also healed spiritually. He replied, "The man called Jesus made some mud and put it on my eyes and told me to go to Siloam and wash. So I went and washed, and then I could see." "Where is this man?" they asked him. "I don't know," he said. You know, we ended our reading of the passage today with a question. It was asked by the blind man's neighbors, "Where is this man?" and the blind man's answer that he does not know where Jesus is at the moment. I ended it deliberately at that point. When we looked at the fourth sign, the feeding of the 5,000, I mentioned to you that the whole rest of chapter 6 is unpacking an exploration of the meaning and implication of Jesus' ability to feed 5,000 men and women with a few loaves of pita bread and anchovies. A similar dynamic is at work here in John 9. The rest of the chapter explores the implication of this healing. It tells us that Jesus is the light of the world. And by the end of the chapter, the blind man finds Jesus, and he realizes that Jesus is the light of the world. He confesses, "Lord, I believe," and the blind man worships Jesus. The physical healing of the blind man is important, but his spiritual healing is a greater thing. And God is glorified in the blind man's testimony. The blind man replied, "The man they called Jesus made some mud and put it on my eyes. He told me to go to Siloam and wash, so I went and washed, and then I could see." The man's physical healing is important. His spiritual healing is more important. Most of all, the truth that God is glorified in this man's life is also important. My friends, there's much suffering in our world. There's much we cannot explain. But we can always ask, how can God be glorified in our response to suffering? Well, I would say that God is glorified in the pouring out of relief to disaster areas after a natural calamity. God is honored in the rescue efforts of the first responders. God is honored in the work of hospital staff and doctors and nurses who treat the wounded. God is honored by those who organize and prepare the pathology reports in order to try and identify the dead. God is honored by those who bury the dead. God is honored by the military who deliver food and water. God is honored by the administrators who organize the relief efforts, attempting to make sure the resources go where the need is. God is honored in the work of on-the-scene chaplains. God is honored in the financial and other donations that are given by individuals and governments. God is honored in the prayers that are offered to his throne on behalf of those who are in need. There are many things in life that are inexplicable. Don't try and explain them. Rather, look for ways in which you can glorify God in how you live your life and respond to the inexplicable. I'm going to close this message with two stories about how God can be at work in our lives in the midst of the suffering and trials that we experience. At a fundraising dinner for a school that serves learning disabled children, the father of one of the school's students offered a question. "Everything God does is done with perfection. Yet my son Shay cannot learn things as other children do. He cannot understand things that other children do. Where is God's plan reflected in my son?" The audience was silent. The father continued, "I believe that when God brings a child like Shay into the world, an opportunity to realize the divine plan presents itself. And it comes in the way people treat that child." Shay and his father were walking past a park where some boys Shay knew were playing baseball. Shay asked his dad, "Do you think they would let me play?" And Shay's father knew that most boys would not want him on their team, but the father understood the importance of this for Shay, and so he approached one of the boys. The boy thought for a few moments, and he said, "You know, we're losing by 6 runs, and the game is in the 8th inning. I guess he can be in our team, and we'll try and put him up to bat in the 9th inning. In the bottom of the 8th inning, Shay's team scored a few runs, but they were still behind by 3. At the top of the 9th inning, Shay put on a glove and played in the outfield. No hits came his way, but he was ecstatic just to be in the field grinning. At the bottom of the 9th inning, Shay's team scored again. And now, with 2 outs, bases loaded, the potential winning run was on base, and Shay was scheduled to be the next at-bat. Would the team actually let Shay bat at this juncture? Surprisingly, Shay was given a bat. Everyone knew that a hit was all but impossible because Shay didn't even really know how to hold the bat properly, much less connect with the ball. However, as Shay stepped to the plate, the pitcher moved a few steps to lob the ball softly so that Shay could at least be able to make contact. The first pitch came, and Shay swung clumsily and missed. The pitcher took a few more steps forward, tossed the ball softly,
And as the pitch came, Shea swung the ball. And hit a slow ground ball to the pitcher. The pitcher picked up the soft ground. It could easily have thrown the ball to first place and it would all have been over. Instead, he pitched the ball high over the first baseman's head. And everyone started yelling, "Shea, run, run." Never in his life had Shea run to a baseball base before. He said, "Run to second, Shea," and he ran to second. He's rounding second, and by this point, the fielder had gotten the ball, and he deliberately throws the ball well over the third baseman's head. They yell, "Shea, round third base, round third base." Shea comes around third base. He's heading towards home. "Run to home, Shea, run." Shea ran home. Stepped on the home plate and was cheered as a hero for hitting the grand slam and winning the game for his team. "That day," said the father softly with tears in his face, "the boys from both teams helped bring about a piece of the divine plan into this world." Here's the second story. During the bad old days of communist rule in Romania, a Romanian pastor was arrested. He was locked in a cell, isolated and beaten. His interrogators threatened his life. They mocked his faith. During one of the beatings, one of the men struck the pastor and mockingly asked, "What can your God do for you now?" The Romanian pastor replied, "God can give me the grace to forgive you." The work of God is revealed in that pastor's answer. The disciples asked Jesus, "Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind?" "Neither this man nor his parents sinned," said Jesus, "but this happened so that the work of God might be displayed in his life." What trials and troubles do you face today, my friend? Let your trials and troubles bring them to God's throne and ask how God's will and life and glory might be displayed through the challenges you face in your life today. Say amen, somebody. Amen.